Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is the website. More than 4,000 interviews there going back to 2003. And sign up for the podcast feed there. And follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. All right, introducing our friend Eric Margolese, author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination, a longtime foreign correspondent, regular writer for his own website, ericmargolese.com, lourockwell.com, and also uns.com. That's UNZ, uns.com. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Eric?
Thank you, Scott. Glad to be back with you.
Very happy to talk with you again, although, man, the subject matter today is something else. I'll tell you, the end of last week, obviously, is the topic. First of all, can we talk about, let's talk about the coup in Turkey first. I guess, well, there's so many different angles. I guess, could you just give us your basic thumbnail sketch of what you think happened or what you think the audience most needs to know about the situation there?
Well, Turkey's a very murky, complex story, and even a lot of Turks don't understand it. It's a here's the bottom line view. Turkey's a big country. It's 80 million people. And within there are all kinds of factions and groups. And up until President Erdogan was elected in 1991 or two, Turkey was in constant chaos and turmoil, fighting between the extreme left and the extreme right, Turkish fascists and communists, and banking crises every week. Turkey was an absolute mess. Since Erdogan, with his AK party, his AK party, we voted in, they have made a miraculous transformation in Turkey from the sick man of Europe and the chaotic man into a thriving economic power, a thriving democracy, and pulled the country better than it's ever been since the Ottoman days. So that's it. And a lot of people were jealous of the success. Two basic groups in Turkey bitterly opposed the Islamist light AK party of Erdogan. And there was one, the traditional Kemalists, as they're known. These were secular, Western-leaning oligarchs who wanted to have nothing to do with Islam, didn't want to be even seen as Turks, wanted a secular republic as established by the modern dictator of Turkey, Kemal Atatürk, wanted to crush Islam, drive it out, and hated anything to do with Islam, and also represented a very dug-in economic oligarchy there, which controlled industry, academia, the media, and most important, the military. Erdogan has pushed them back to their barracks. And this has been a struggle for over a decade. The other group are the Gulenists. I don't want to run on too long, but it's not
easy. I want you to.
Okay, the Gulenists. This is a really weird story, Scott. There's this self-proclaimed holy man named Fethullah Gulen, who's in his 70s, and he was an ally of Erdogan. And he has Turkey has these very powerful brotherhoods, as they're called. They're called like Masonic orders, whatever you want, that sort of operate under the radar. And his was very, very large, and it controlled a lot of the educational establishment, legal establishment, and was very influential in the media and in the military. But Erdogan fell out. And this strange man, Gulen, fled to, of all places, rural Pennsylvania, where he has a large estate and runs sort of like a cult from there. He has been at war, been trying to overthrow Erdogan using his infiltrated sources in academia, in the military, in the press. Apparently, according to what happened last week, it looked like a combination of Kemalist right-wing army officers who were facing reassignment or downgrading, and the Gulenists, who were out for Erdogan's scalp, tried to stage this coup, and it was a big fizzle.
Right. Now, so... Well, one of my main questions I guess I got to get to first here on the follow-up is, what do you think about a possible U.S. role here, or at least the American reaction to the coup as it unfolded?
I would not like to think that the U.S. was involved in it, but I do have some dark suspicions that it's possible that there was some U.S. involvement. In the past, before Erdogan's AK party took over, the army ran everything, and in fact, hanged one of the father of one of my classmates years ago. And the army ran everything, and they reported directly to the Pentagon. There's no need for State Department or anything else. They just called up the Pentagon in Washington, asking, "Well, you know, what should we do?" It was, in this sense, very much like a typical Latin American army of the 1960s or 70s. And then they were close to the U.S. The U.S. has a very important air base at Incirlik, you know, the far end of the country, which they used to bomb the Middle East, and by the way, where they revealed to be stored from 30 to 60 nuclear hydrogen bombs. And the... There's intense antipathy towards Erdogan in the U.S. media and in U.S. ruling circles. The neocons hate him because he has actually had the audacity to criticize Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. So he's been marked for death by them. The military is not happy with him. The establishment is not happy because, first of all, he's a Muslim. And that's already three strikes against him. And number two, he doesn't always follow instructions from Washington. So that's put him in the doghouse as far as a lot of the American media and thought merchants are concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's quite a consensus. And, well, and let's get back to more details about, you know, some of where he spends outside of his normal, you know, prescribed channels in a second. But there was one thing I wanted to follow up, not to nitpick, but just to make sure I understood you right. You said 1992, and I just wondered if you were referring to the very beginnings of his political career, or if you meant to say 2002.
No, I was the beginnings of his political career.
Oh, I see. I just wanted to make sure I understood that right. What doldrums the country was in back then in the early 90s, and now he helped start turning that around even back then, you're saying?
He's performed a remarkable renaissance in Turkey, uplifting half of its people from poverty and almost oblivion in central Anatolia to an important status, making Turkey an industrial power, making it respected, and most of all, bringing stability to the political and economic process.
Mm-hmm. But then, okay, so it seems like, you know, where he spun out, I mean, you mentioned he criticized Israel, he even stood up to them a little bit after the Mavi Marmara and all that. But, and so, you know, that explains Michael Rubin's problem and why he was promoting regime change in Newsweek a couple of months ago. You know, famous from the Office of Special Plans and the neocons there. But, you know, I wonder, and this is something that we've talked about for a long time running now, it's sort of Kremlinology or whatever, but to what degree was Erdogan's support, I mean, and I think in this case, direct support for the al-Nusra Front and at least indirect wink-nudge type support for the Islamic State that went on for years there. How much of that was outside of Obama's program in Syria? How much of that was, you know, was any of that what you're referring to when you say, you know, the military and the establishment in America were getting sick of this guy? Was it because Obama kind of had second thoughts about Syria, but he kept on?
No, Scott, I don't think so. The Turkish intelligence directorate marches to its own tune and is very influential, but operates very subtly behind the scenes. And the Turks said, well, look, the Americans are demanding that we do something to follow their position in Syria, but we have our own interests. Sort of a little like Pakistan in Afghanistan. You know, it says, yes, boss, to the Americans, then it goes and does its own thing. Turks did the same thing. And they're, for the Turks, made a terrible mistake, in my view, in trying to join the lynch mob going against mild-mannered President Assad in Damascus. And they, before the policy followed by even the Erdogan government was a no-problems policy. And we make nice to all of our neighbors. And they did. Things were very successful, but then something happened, and Erdogan got a bee in his bonnet about Assad in Syria, decided to overthrow him, and the Turkish intelligence agency was given a green light to start sending in rebels and Nusra fronts, all kinds of crazies, and arming them, because that's where the supply lines for all these Syrian rebel groups run across the Turkish border. So the Turks were playing a kind of a crafty double game, which ended up blowing up in their faces.
Yeah. I mean, Phil Giraldi talked about being, I think, in Ankara and seeing ISIS fundraising guys, you know, out on the streets, you know, directly raising money for the Islamic State. And that would have been back in, I guess, 2014, as late as then. But yeah, they've had a recent major Islamic State attack, and I guess a couple more before that. So they really have dropped that policy by now, huh?
Well, not 100%, but let's say 90%. What they're doing now is ultra discreet.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that people were saying about the coup was, oh, look, Erdogan was saying he wanted to kiss and make up with the Russians and he wanted to kiss and make up with Assad, and then the coup comes. But Phil Giraldi in his article says, nah, if anything, they would, you know, the military would have liked that. They're overthrowing him for causing trouble with the Russians and the Syrians this whole time, where they would have preferred that he had not.
I think a better reason is that in August, the military ranks are being reviewed on a mass scale, and the promotions and demotions will be made as a typical military process. And a lot of senior officers felt that they were not going to be made promotion and be forced to resign because of their Gulenist or Kemalist sympathies. And that's when they decided to strike. I think that was the key reason. Mm-hmm.
And what do you think about, I don't know if you've seen Giraldi, Larry Johnson, Pat Lang, and some of these other former intelligence guys are saying, and Phil says in his article on the American Conservative Today, that at least what they're being told is that when Erdogan, he figured out that they were going for this coup. So he had senior officers tell them, yeah, go ahead, we're with you. But they really weren't. They were loyal to the president. But he went ahead and baited them into moving early in order to kind of, you know, nab them and then expand his power after the fact.
Well, that's one idea I've seen expressed. The Turks, you know, are noted for subtlety and intrigue. Now, I remember the Ottoman Empire for hundreds of years was run out of the harem in Istanbul by a bunch of intriguing concubines. And they like that kind of stuff. I said they're very subtle, the Turks, sometimes too subtle for their own good. It's possible, but I don't think that this thing was cooked up by Erdogan, I was thinking this morning of Mao's, Thousand Flowers Blossom campaign, where anybody who had, he encouraged anybody who was opposed to government policies to step up to the plate and say it openly to people. Well, all the people who did got arrested and disappeared. So yes, it's possible, but I think there are more, there's simpler reasons for it, as I mentioned, with the promotion thing and the fact that, you know, Erdogan's opponents hate his guts. And they have failed totally to damage him in the polling process. He wins every election bigger and better and stronger. Mm-hmm. And the only way they can do that is try and overthrow him, which they just did this last weekend.
Mm. Well, yeah, speaking of intrigue and all that, there was, and they pretty much got caught, right, back in 2014, at least plotting. They never did it, but it was leaked, their plot to do a false flag attack on that shrine in Syria that it's sort of like protected, you know, almost like an embassy protected Turkish territory, holy inside Syria. And they're going to fake an attack on their own troops guarding it so as to have an excuse to invade, to protect it.
Heartwarming. They must have learned that from the Pentagon.
Well, wait, we're going to get to that in a minute. And then, of course, there was, you know, the red line and the rat line and the plot to arm up the al-Nusra front with sarin gas in order to frame Bashar al-Assad back in August 2013.
That's right. This a complete disinformation campaign.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Crazy stuff. All right, now, so this guy Gulen lives in Pennsylvania. So doesn't that mean that this whole thing is a CIA job or what?
Well, I don't know. I don't have any evidence one way or the other. I have my suspicions, and I think, yes, I think the U.S. is using Gulen as a sort of secret weapon to use against Erdogan if he gets out of hand, mm-hmm. and if he becomes non-responsive to Washington's demands. What I find is interesting is that the Turks have been demanding his extradition for a long time to Turkey and for terrorism issues. And the U.S. has refused to consider them. Just yesterday, I think, John Kerry said that, well, okay, the U.S. would consider an extradition request if made properly and if filled with, facts and figures proving his terrorist attacks. What's so interesting was in 2003, the U.S. wanted bin Laden, who was in Afghanistan, and demanded that the Afghans hand him over, and the Afghans replied quite rightfully. They said, fine, send us a legitimate extradition request with facts and figures, and we'll send him to a Muslim country with impartial judiciary. Well, the Americans said no, and they went and invaded Afghanistan instead. So on this precedent, the Turks might have a president to go and invade Pennsylvania and grab this guy.
Yeah, exactly. Drone strikes coming to the Pocono soon. All right, so now the rumor is at least that the Turkish commander of the Incirlik Air Base was placed under arrest, and for a while they laid siege to the place and turned off the power, which I guess the Americans still have auxiliary power there. But the implication, I guess, and this could just be a PR stunt on Erdogan's part, right? But the implication being that he was trying to blame the U.S. for what had happened there, right? No?
Well, there is a strong feeling in Turkey, certainly within the government, but in the street as well, that the U.S. was behind this. While the coup was underway, the American media reporting was dripping with Schadenfreude and bad-mouthing Erdogan constantly. I was amazed watching CNN they couldn't have been any more anti-Turkish than its worst enemies. And it's almost as if the media was had been prepped or given some kind of advance warning that something would happen. Let's get this guy out of here and put one of our guys in.
Yeah, especially on Fox. They were ready. They were, or I don't know, ready, but they were excited anyway, that's for sure.
But, yeah, they smelled blood.
Yeah, well, and, you know, Kerry's original statement was something like, well, you know, he kind of prefers stability and continuity. Didn't say a thing about the current elected government of the country at all. It wasn't until, you know, I was following it on Twitter as this is all developing, where it wasn't until about 3 hours into the coup when it was clearly failing and the president was on his way back to the airport to take control. And then Obama and Kerry had put out a thing that was supposedly a readout of their phone call where they agreed that, yes, this was a very bad thing indeed. And they supported Chavez's retaking of power in the palace. I mean, Erdogan's retaking of power in the palace.
But with support with faint praise. What I also found particularly revolting was Kerry, who's not a bad guy, but came out and said, well, you know, we are cautioning Turkey to observe democratic principles and rule of law and don't crack down too hard on these people. To be a democracy, you've got to be careful what you do. Just down the Mediterranean is Egypt, a close American ally. We helped overthrow the Morsi government in Egypt. And the Egyptian military junta, led by this awful little tin pot dictator, Field Marshal al-Sisi, as he styles himself, is not criticized at all. They just shoot down demonstrators in the street, torture people, and disappear them. And that's hunky-dory with Washington. But Turks, you have to behave, or else.
Yeah, Kerry called the 2013 coup in Egypt the restoration of democracy.
Yeah, that's really... I don't know who's writing his lines for him.
Terry Gilliam, maybe?
Yeah, or William Crystal.
Yeah. Oh, man. All right, so... let's talk about France a little bit here. I don't know how credible it is, but one anonymous leak from the press this morning was, that the truck attacker there on Bastille Day in Nice, France, was growing his beard out, and he'd been palling around with some political/Islamic radicals, and he had complained to a friend that, why can't the Islamic State have some land anyway on the eve of this? Then again, everything before that said that the guy, you know, was basically psychotic and was on heavy medication, not just Zoloft or something, but was on some pretty serious antipsychotic medication and had been divorced from his wife. And I don't know. You tell me what you make of all this.
I think it was one guy who just went screwy. We have that every day in the United States now, some lunatic ones in a shirt shooting people. He just had a more original way of killing, which actually started in Palestine, where Palestinians who were enraged at the Israelis in reprisal would take their trucks or cars and drive them into groups of Israelis. And this is exactly what this guy did. His wife had just left him. He lost his job. He was psycho. Yeah, the French government is now saying, well, we believe it's an act of terrorism. Well, terrorism lets everybody off the hook. You have no other responsibility. Oh, it's terrorists and they're evil. Kill them. And it is proclaimed that it's at war now with terrorism, which is not quite the case. And but the French government has just declared a state of war, and it's calling up reserve troops and beating the wardrobes. This is, in my view, President Hollande's last desperate gasp at gaining some popularity. I think he's down to about 8%, in which is include his relatives and his mother. He's facing oblivion politically. So, as we know from our own American experience, screaming terrorism is the best way to reboot your fortunes.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. And, you know, it's, I mean... Everybody always tries to take this wrong, like it's somehow an excuse or anything like that. But it seems to me, even if you take what they're saying now at face value, that it did have a, you know, Islamist political, Islamic state bent to it. Well, dang, isn't today the fifth anniversary of you reporting to me that the French were helping the Americans build a revolution in France? And, you know, we're helping jihadists basically to try to overthrow Assad. And then isn't it right now pretty much exactly the 2-year anniversary of you and me talking about how, oh yeah, now that the Islamic State has grown from a group to a place, now America and France are going to stab them in the back and go to war against them. This is the context of the entire thing. So even if on the margin in this psycho's mind, an Islamic State motive finally helped push him over the edge that he was going to do this thing on behalf of them somehow or whatever it was, still in the context, not that it's justified, but it's still blowback from a French and American policy that did not have to be in Syria this whole time. They chose to make that policy in Syria this whole time, Eric.
That's right, Scott, but Americans don't understand this. It's too deep and murky for them. It's just... they don't understand it. And, you know, it's saying, oh, it's Islamic terrorists, possibly Islamic terrorists. Well, you know, everybody from, almost everybody from the Middle East are Muslims. And anybody who commits an act of violence for political reasons or reasons of dementia or whatever, suddenly it's terrorism. Well, we have a huge growth industry in terrorism. We have large sectors of the government which rely on it. So it will go on, and if we can't find terrorists, we manufacture them like the FBI is doing in the States, where they get these poor numbskulls and fill them up with Muscatel wine and have them coach them on what to say that they're Islamic terrorists.
Mm. Now that you've mentioned terrorists and the FBI, well, terrorists in the United States and the FBI, have you had a chance to read the 28 pages?
No, I haven't yet. I've been so busy with the Turks and the French. All I've seen are reports saying that there's nothing interesting in them. Have you read it?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can take that headline to the bank then if you want to. What I read in there was it basically is beyond dispute now that Prince Bandar himself was running the guys that crashed into the Pentagon. The guys who were known by the CIA to have been co-conspirators in the coal plot, which was forged at the same Malaysia meeting where the 9/11 plot was, you know, more or less finalized there. And so, and, you know, the guy, the Saudi agents in San Diego helped these guys on every level. We already knew quite a bit of this, but on every level, including putting them in the flight schools and all the money direct from Bandar, not just from his wife to the other guy's wife, but direct from Bandar to the bad guys. And the whole context of them covering this up all in the year 2002 when they're busy lying us into war with Iraq, Eric.
Interesting. Well,
it's a hell of a thing. I can't wait for your write-up on it once you read that thing. I mean, here's my thing, and I'm totally going off in cuckoo land here. I don't care, but I'll just go ahead and say it. I got to wonder, why would Bandar do something like that? He's going to stab Bush Jr., the son of his best buddy, Bush Sr., right in the chest? Not even in the back, but right in the face? And then he's going to smoke cigars with him on the Truman balcony 3 days later?
Good question, Scott. That's why I haven't gotten into it. I haven't figured out what the plot is behind there.
Yeah, I don't know. And you know what? Honestly, I don't want to read too much into it and say, well, you know, between the lines, it's 100% proven fact that Bandar knew exactly what these dudes were going to do. I guess it's possible they were trying to recruit them as double agents to work for our side or the Saudi side inside Al-Qaeda, but they got double-crossed or that kind of thing. You know, it's not all definitive, but I say just put Bandar up on the gallows and wrap the rope around his neck and see if he starts squealing.
He's a nasty guy. And what about the Israelis who were tailing these? That's not in there.
That's not in the 28, nope.
Or the dancing Israeli moving men in Newark. Yeah. As the
Well, we know that there's FBI reporting on that from what they told Carl Cameron, that there is at least 302s, even if they never came up with anything to hand over to Congress. They came up with something on that stuff, the FBI.
I don't trust anybody. We've had so much deceit and lying reporting in the media, same thing out of Congress, that we have to be very skeptical of anything we get and anything that's declassified.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and for example, one of the things in there is that Abu Zubaydah had Prince Bandar's vacation phone number to his vacation house in Aspen. And yet, we know about that at the time this thing was written, they assumed that Zubaydah was the number three man in Al-Qaeda and a 9/11 co-conspirator, but actually that's not true. Right, he was somebody, but he was not loyal to Bin Laden. He was not a high level member of Al Qaeda, and
just caught up in the dragnet.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's interesting that he had Bandar's number, but it's not necessarily a link to the 9/11 plot at all. There, that's, you know, it's sort of a stray data point that looks like it could be something, I guess, but you know, maybe not. But anyway, sort of like with the WikiLeaks State Department cables and the military cables. Yeah, the cable says a thing, so that's news that the cable says a thing, but it doesn't mean that what the cable says is correct necessarily, depending on what it is. You know, there's all kinds of crap in there. But yeah. Anyway, so listen, thanks for coming on the show and talking with me about this stuff. I feel very privileged to have access to you, sir.
I'm delighted to be back with you on this important and interesting news story. See you at the next crisis, Scott.
Thanks again, Eric. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
All right, y'all. That's our good buddy, Eric Margolies. War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. Those are the books. And find them at ericmargolies.com, lewrockwell.com, and unz.com, unz.com. For all his latest articles. And I forgot the title, but his latest is about France, and it's a really good one. We're going to run it tomorrow on antiwar.com. Thanks, y'all, very much. ScottHorton.org for the website, all the archives, 4,000 interviews. Sign up for the podcast feed there so you get all of them. And hey, why not drop by ScottHorton.org/donate and help support the show. If you donate 50 or 100 or 200 bucks, there's all kinds of great kickbacks for you, including a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think Libertarian audiobooks. And I like Bitcoins, too. If you like getting rid of Bitcoins, stop by ScottHorton.org/donate. And follow me on Twitter, @ScottHortonShow. Thanks, y'all, very much. Appreciate it. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Superior blends of premium coffee. Roasted fresh in Zionsville, Indiana. Darren's Coffee satisfies the casual and the connoisseur. Scott Horton Show listeners, visit darrenscoffee.com and use the coupon code SCOTT at checkout for free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.